How do we go in and provide much more intensive support, but for a specific period of time, in the hopes that within that time, we can sustainably alter the course of that person's life? And that the program has been extremely successful at doing.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The graduation approach to helping people to escape from poverty was pioneered all the way back in 2002 by BRAC in Bangladesh. Today, the model is used around the world. So in more than 20 years, what have we learned about how it works, when and where it works best, and how to implement it at scale? Shamaran Abed, the executive director of BRAC International, is clearly the person to ask about that. And he joins me now. Shamaran, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So am I. Shamaran, take us back to 2002. Why was the graduation approach formulated at that time? What was the thinking behind it?
Actually, I'll have to take you a little bit further back to the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. As some of your listeners might know, BRAC was founded in Bangladesh in the early 70s, had done almost more than two decades of work, had become a very large development organization within Bangladesh, quite different from many other development organizations in the way that it was born in the Global South, worked with communities, developed programs, looked at poverty in a much more holistic way, understanding that it is multidimensional and that there was no single intervention or a single sector that one could work on that would transform people's lives or help people pull themselves out of poverty. We'd have to come at it from all different directions. And so BRAC had already done work in health and education and livelihoods and microfinance, on social protection, had set up social enterprises to plug market gaps in the value chain issues in rural Bangladesh for many years. It took a long time for BRAC to realize that a lot of its interventions were actually not reaching the poorest of the poor.
Right.
And there was some research that came out by Bangladeshi researchers in the mid-90s that was suggesting that there is a group of people who are so vulnerable, they're so marginalized, that they're almost invisible. Unless you go looking for them, you can't find them easily. They're just so at the margins of society that even when you set up programs and you think you're reaching poor people, you're leaving out the very poorest. And so BRAC then started to look at this very seriously in the late 90s, saying, why are our programs not reaching the poorest people? Because that's actually who we are for. Microfinance was becoming popular around the world at the time. There was a sense at that time that maybe microfinance was reaching the poorest people, that our health interventions, that our livelihoods work. But actually, BRAC realized that the research was correct. There was a group of people at the very bottom of society, at the very base of the pyramid. And these were typically households headed by women, where the men had either abandoned them or had died. And these women were left to fend for themselves and their children, typically in situations where they were facing all kinds of economic and social barriers. So much so that they would basically have to beg and plead and live on other people's land. And really, a term that was coined around that time is they worked like the hated poor, as in nobody liked them. Nobody wanted to associate with them. They were sort of a burden to society. So the society shunned these people. And so they were very much on the margins of it. And from that realization that these people are so marginalized that unless we specifically target them and we specifically build programming that addresses their particular vulnerabilities, which are all the typical ones and then some more, we wouldn't be able to have sustainable impact on the lives of these very, very poor women and their families. But that's basically where the idea came from. The design work started in the very late 90s, in the very early 2000s, and there was a lot of people involved with a lot of that thinking, BRAC staff, BRAC leadership, researchers at BRAC. BRAC used to have a research and evaluation division of its own that later got merged with BRAC University once BRAC University was set up, but also a lot of external researchers and academics and practitioners as well. And what BRAC tried to do, as BRAC always tries to do, is try to bring the best ideas from anywhere and see what would work for these women at the very base of the pyramid. And so the program design happened. And then in 2002, the first cohort of program participants were brought in. But the idea and the work behind it took at least probably 5 years to get to that point.
I seem to remember at the beginning, it was called the TUP, Targeting the Ultra Poor program. In that concept, then, that idea that BRAC had to reach these people who could not be reached by conventional methods, what was that concept for what the program would provide?
I think you hit on a very important thing, which is the name itself. It was called Targeting the Ultra Poor because the targeting was such an important element of the program, because BRAC realized unless you're very good at targeting, we're not even going to reach the right people. And a lot of work was done in the early days about how do we make sure that the participants who are coming into this program really are the ultra poor, make sure that other people aren't coming into the program or ultra poor aren't being left out of the program. And that continues to take a lot of effort, actually. So in the early design, BRAC decided on using participatory rural appraisal, basically going to the communities, sitting within the village with the people of that village to do a social mapping and a wealth ranking together with the village to say, who are the poorest people in this village? Where do they live? And how do we bring them into the program? So instead of BRAC staff deciding who the poorest people within those villages and those communities are, it was the village and the community itself that was doing the selection. That also was an important part of the program design itself, because then BRAC would go in with 2 years of pretty intensive support, and we would require the rest of that village and the community to come together and support that within those ultra-poor households. And so including them early in from the very design and selection was a very important part of that program design. And so much so that the name got put in to the name of the program itself and became known as Targeting the Ultra-Poor Program.
This concept of graduation, that was in there from the start. Could you explain what people are graduating out of? What are they graduating into?
Unlike traditional social protection programs, where you put people on a scheme, let's say, whether it's a food for work scheme or a cash transfer scheme or a conditional cash transfer scheme, a lot of what we saw and continue to see is that once you put people onto those programs, then they remain perennially in those programs. And that's been the experience in Bangladesh as well.
Yeah,
I think Bangladesh still has more than 100 social protection or social safety net programs that the government of Bangladesh runs, from widow benefits to old age benefits to unemployment benefits to disability benefits. But typically, these tend to be very small amounts of money given regularly. So you get a drip, as we say, usually on a monthly basis. This drip allows you to survive, but doesn't allow you to change the course of your life. It doesn't allow you to move out of anything. So a big part of the idea with the graduation program is how do we go in and provide much more intensive support, but for a specific period of time, in the hopes that within that time, we can sustainably alter the course of that person's life. We couldn't go with another traditional drip type thing. We'd have to go in with a big upfront investment into that household. That would have to be complemented with a range of additional wraparound services. So it's not just enough to give that investment, but how do we ensure that that household then has the ability to leverage that investment, to earn, to build resilience, and in a way that over time that family can get on a pathway out of ultra poverty, right? So at the end of 2 years, the idea is that, you know, these very, very poor women and their families, they're not moving out of poverty per se, but they're moving out of that trap they're in and graduating them onto a path where they can continue to progress over time and get out of that kind of debilitating, dehumanizing poverty that they're in. And that the program has been extremely successful at doing. So what we've seen is not only that in the 2 years that the situation in these households changed, but that you'd of course expect given the amount of intensive support that the household is receiving. But more importantly, once the program ends after 2 years, if we go back and track these same households over time, are they continuing to progress or are they falling back into poverty? And what we see is the vast majority of graduates continue to progress. Of course, they go on to other programs. They get connected to other benefits that the government provides. Sometimes they become part of microfinance groups, self-help groups, savings groups. But whatever it is, we're trying to get them out of a situation which is quite hopeless to a point where they feel like, yes, I've now got a base from which to go forward.
That investment in the ultra poor pretended to be something like a livestock or something like that, which was an asset which would also generate an income?
Typically, what we found were the most effective ways to get them to get into sustainable livelihoods would be some form of a livestock, poultry, sometimes land cultivation, sometimes small shops, small trading, but a lot of it was mainly around livestock.
Now, at the time, something like this hadn't been attempted before. It's a bit of a risk for you because it's also a very intensive, relatively expensive program. How much of a risk was this for BRAC? How certain were they that it would work?
I'm not sure I can say they were entirely certain that it would work.
Yeah.
But I think given that in 2002, BRAC would have just turned 30. So it had 30 years of experience in Bangladesh trying out different things. And of course, it had tried to look at what others had been trying around the world. And so that it had brought a lot of that knowledge, experience, and thinking into the program. I think there was a sense that if we can really do it well, this had a good chance of showing some really positive results. But of course, anytime you do something new, and it, as you said, it was the first time something of this nature had been tried, at least to our knowledge, you're taking a risk. And you need supporters and funders who are also taking that risk with you. And I suppose we were lucky that we had DFID at the time, now FCDO, the UK government. We had several other bilaterals as well, including the Australian government, that really came with us on that journey in the early days and took a chance. And I think, yeah, I can't say the organization was entirely certain, but I think there was a sense that we might be onto something. Fairly soon after probably the first couple of cohorts, there was a sense that, yes, this is working and this is worth scaling and spreading, probably even before the actual formal evaluations, the RCTs came out, which would have been another 4 or 5 years later.
We will be back in a moment.
Throughout West Africa, women leaders are driving meaningful change.
You have to think about the way the country looks at its women and how it views its girls.
Hear their stories in the podcast, Women Leading Change, brought to you by the Sahel and West Africa Club at the OECD.
We've neglected our indigenous foods, which were historically very healthy.
I'm your host, Dr. Lena Coney Hoffman. Tune in and be inspired as we explore the connections between gender and climate change, food systems, conflict, and urban expansion.
Women have risen to protect their children, to protect their families, to protect communities in the face of real terrorism.
So, Shamarin, just before the break, you did mention the rounds of RCTs that have been conducted on this. These programs cannot be easy to measure if we were trying to capture their effectiveness because, by definition, they are multidimensional and they run over a long period of time. But how important is rigorously measuring their effectiveness?
I think from BRAC's point of view, it's extremely important to rigorously measure the effectiveness of all programs that we run, all interventions, programs, social enterprises. We continuously ask ourselves, are these programs having impact? Are we reaching the right people? Are we doing the right things? And are we doing them in the right way? Now, that doesn't mean that everything requires an RCT, because RCT, by their very design, lend themselves to certain types of programming more than others. But whether it's an RCT or some other methodology, the rigorous evaluations and continuously making sure that we are achieving the results and the impacts that we set out to do is extremely important, at least from BRAC's point of view.
So tell me a little bit about what you have learned. First of all, who is this working well for? Do we know more about that now and who might be better targeted by other forms of intervention?
I think we have some sense of that, having done this over many years. Now, obviously, the program itself is for very vulnerable people. Since it's designed for them, it does work for people in very difficult situations and with a tremendous amount of vulnerability. But at the same time, there is a sense in this program, as with most BRAC programs, that it is the poor themselves that work to bring themselves out of poverty.
Yeah.
Right? So we see ourselves as an organization that facilitates, that provides the right kinds of resources, assets, training, we lend our experience, we do the handholding, but it's really the poor themselves that have to do the hard work of changing the course of their lives and transforming their lives. And that's what we've seen with this program itself. But that does mean that it works with people who are able to put in that work in themselves. That doesn't mean that you have to be always able-bodied and have to work. Even with disabled households, we've done this program. But at the end of the day, you need people to be able to work hard and get themselves out of this program. Over time, when we've worked with younger populations, it's worked very well. We've worked a lot with older populations as well. But given, again, the very intensive programming and the cost of the program, we've got to ask, who is it best targeted to? And for whom maybe the more traditional social protection programs are better. So if you're very ill, if your disability is such that it stops you from working, and you don't have anyone else in the household that can work, if you're very elderly, where it's very difficult for you to do the kind of work that it requires, more traditional social safety nets, social protection might be better suited. But for most people that we've worked with over the course of the last 23 years, we found that the graduation program is extremely effective. They just need to be able to believe in it and work towards it.
Now that programming and the handholding, as you describe it, you have formalized that structure somewhat over the years, that there is a sequencing of how you introduce the different dimensions of the intervention. How important is it to follow that structure, that process? What is the process now?
It's very important to follow a process and a structure, a sequence, but it's not the same everywhere because the contexts are quite different. Even if you look at the way the program is structured and sequenced today in Bangladesh in 2025, it's quite different from what it was in 2002 or even 2005, right? Because with changes in the local dynamics and changes in the context, we've had to say, okay, let's do a little bit less of this. Mm-hmm. Let's do a little bit more of that. I'll give you one quick example. In Bangladesh, in the early days, there was a fairly hefty stipend that went with the program. So there was the asset, but then every month for about a year, the household would also get a cash transfer. And the idea was that we didn't want the household to sell the asset and consume it. Like, they didn't want them to use it for consumption.
Of course, yes.
So we wanted to give them this consumption support so that the asset they would protect and the productivity over time, that would become a productive asset. We don't do that cash transfer anymore because the situation is not the same anymore. We don't feel that that's an important element of the program. But what we later started doing is savings matching, for example, because we wanted to build greater resilience. We wanted these households to be able to transition more easily to, let's say, microfinance programs or other kinds of programs. And we thought having a more robust savings base would be the thing to invest in. So the stipends dropped off, the savings matching came in about 8 or 9 years ago, and even that's changed over time. So the program is continuously iterating and getting better. So if you look at the program in Uganda, where we're working with people with disabilities, if you look at the program that we ran recently in Liberia, again, looks a little bit different. But it's very important to think about the local context, the particular vulnerabilities you're trying to address, and to create a structure and a sequence that works. Now, obviously, in a broad sense, you go in, you do the targeting, you bring the participants into the program. Usually over the first couple of months, you do some training and conscientization. You go in with the big push investment, usually an asset. Could be a skill or a training, but it tends to be an asset usually. And then the wraparound services come in over the course of the next probably 18 or so months. There are other kinds of support that you want to give around that time. Yeah, it's very important to design it for a particular community in a particular context, but there has to be thought and rigor put in behind the design. And that structure, if we can follow it well, we get good results. But also at the same time, we always keep asking ourselves, is it still the best design? Has something changed? Should we change something? And that's a continuous conversation we continue to have within the organization.
The original description very much assumes a rural, ultra-poor community. Can this also be extended to the ultra-poor living in cities?
I'm convinced it can be. We're seeing some early signs of organizations, even governments, contextualizing it for the urban poor. Now, as we all know, that poverty is actually moving from rural areas into urban areas. So sure, it is an area where we'll need to put a lot more of our effort into in the future. And there are certain dynamics within the urban context, which are quite different. So in the rural context, people are typically on ancestral land. They've been in that area for a long time. They've got, even if you have very little social capital, at least you have some there. Once people move to the cities and they go into these large urban slums, everything is different, right? You have no tenurial security. You could get evicted anytime by the city corporation or the government. You know, your neighbors are from all different parts of the country. You're all doing different types of trade. Your earnings and your work is very uncertain, very fragile. And so we're working with a very different scenario. And so how do we adapt this program? We've given a lot of thought to it. So for example, you talked about livestock. You can't do livestock transfers.
No, absolutely.
In an urban slum. There just isn't the space. And where would they graze? So then you're looking at specific trades. You're looking at, in some cases, skills training, small shops, other vocational training and things like that as the main investment. And then how do you do also the wraparound services, the handholding, the confidence building in a very different kind of situation? In urban areas, there are problems of drugs and there are problems of crime and there are problems of the mafia that controls certain areas and certain slums that you have to pay to live somewhere or to be a rickshaw puller. And there are all these different things that you've got to take into consideration. So yes, we've got to make sure that this can also work in urban settings. We're running graduation programs in urban settings ourselves. Other partners are doing it as well. We are trying it in Bihar in India in an urban setting being run by the government, the state government of Bihar. So there are many examples of this being tried out. We don't still have the kind of evidence in an urban setting as we do in rural settings, but I'm sure the evidence will follow.
Sadly, there are still millions of people who would qualify for this approach. What have we learned about how to apply this approach at scale, particularly because it is resource intensive and might run into budgeting constraints?
If you look at the global situation now, obviously over many decades, at least the total percentage of people living in extreme poverty and the numbers of people living in extreme poverty have come down significantly. If you take a long-term view and you think 60 years ago in the mid-1960s, out of 3 billion people in the world, 2 billion of them were in extreme poverty. And if you fast forward 60 years, and now about 10% of 8 billion people, or a little bit less than that maybe, live in extreme poverty. So that's a huge amount of progress. But still, if we're thinking of somewhere between 600 and 800 million people living in extreme poverty, it's high. It's too high.
It's 800 million too high, yes.
100, 150 million households living in extreme poverty in a world where there is so much wealth. That's something that's really unacceptable. Having said that, there is a lot of resources and there is a lot of wealth in the world today. I often say, on average, an ultra-poor graduation program over 2 years costs about $1,000 per household. It's not exactly $1,000. In some places, it's $1,500. In some parts of the world, it's less than that. But I'm just saying, for the sake of argument, let's say on average, it's $1,000 per household. If we wanted to take 100 million families out of ultra-poverty during the graduation program, $100 million times $1,000 is $100 billion. So $100 billion potentially could solve this problem. Now, $100 billion sounds like a lot of money, but there are individuals who have more money than that. It's not the total amount of money that's necessarily the problem. And if you look at how much money governments spend around the world, especially these newer middle-income countries where a lot of the ultra-poor live, I'm thinking about countries like India, Indonesia, Philippines, even Bangladesh, governments are spending large amounts of money on anti-poverty programs. And so a lot of that $100 billion is probably already there, being programmed in some way by governments already. What we need to build is the capacity to implement these programs. You've got to get governments particularly to understand that there is a tremendous amount of evidence that already exists about what works. And the graduation approach is an approach that has a tremendous amount of evidence that it does work. And if we can take some of that learning into these very large-scale government programs, I'm not saying we don't need more money, but even before we add more money to it, we could get a huge amount of additional benefit out of programs that are already being run. We need to make sure that the money that is already being spent by governments and NGOs around the world are better spent and we get better return on investment, a much higher level of impact. And that we feel that we can do. Even if somebody wrote me a check for $100 billion right now and said, go and solve this problem, I couldn't necessarily solve this problem because the capacity doesn't exist to be able to spend that kind of money. So it's as much capacity as the money itself.
imagine the graduation approach as a sort of a gift through BRAC that Bangladesh has given to the world now, because now it is being applied in many other places. Are there any that you would pick out where you have seen that approach being used with success?
I think there are many programs being run by different institutions, NGOs, even governments that are working. The bigger question for us right now is, are they scaling?
Yeah.
Are we seeing the same kind of impact, and are they being taken to scale? Because we can continue to pilot for years and years, but ultimately we've got to take these programs to scale, and we have to ensure that as we scale, we continue to work on the quality aspects of the program. So the fidelity to design, we want to make sure that there is a strong fidelity to design, that we continue to ask that these programs are continuing to make impact, but that we're also achieving scale. Mm-hmm. Now that we are starting to see. Yeah, so that's the encouraging bit. We're seeing, for example, again, I'll go back to India, where not only is the federal government, but several state governments are starting to put significant amounts of money into their own programs, but those programs have significant elements of the graduation approach built into them. And those governments are working with us and other partners to ensure that they're designing those programs in such a way that they can get the ultra poor onto a sustainable pathway out of poverty. So we're seeing a lot of traction with other governments. Many governments are at different stages. We're working with the government of Rwanda very seriously. They already have a national graduation strategy, and we're trying to make sure that strategy gets implemented on the ground in the right way, but done by multiple partners, and we're supporting that. We're working with the largest social protection program in South Africa, SASSA. Again, in some places, we are further along in our relationship with the government and the way we're engaging, but we are engaging across several countries, including Indonesia and the Philippines, really trying to make sure that what we've learned over the course of the last two decades, we can share that. It is a gift. I mean, we do say that it is a global public good. We might have created it, but it's gone way beyond BRAC now. And we have no IP rights. It's not proprietary. It's something that we as a global community now are working to improve and scale. And in that effort, we continue to work with others.
Yes, this is something I was going to ask you about. If I was doing this interview about some commercial product, a large tech company or something, everything would be covered with little trademark signs by now. And there would be restrictions on its use. And there would be a large committee deciding who could qualify to describe things this way. Sometimes you see some people claiming the graduation approach, and you look into it and you think, it's not quite what I would describe as the graduation approach. Who has control at this point over being able to protect the quality of this public good?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure there is a global authority that can certify whether a program meets the minimum criteria, then the essential criteria for being even called a graduation program. And you're absolutely right. There are lots of programs around the world that have taken one or two elements of graduation and then renamed their programs a graduation program. I feel very encouraged by the fact that there is so much interest in graduation and people want to do it. And I think we need to encourage that and not put so many restrictions around that that people feel like, okay, that's BRAC's thing. And only BRAC gets to decide whether my program is of the right quality or it's even graduation. So I don't think we'd want to play that role. But I think as a community of practice and working with partners, we work very closely, for example, with the Partnership for Economic Inclusion at the World Bank, which we also helped to set up. There is a global community of practice around graduation. And I think most organizations that are part of that really want to both protect but also promote graduation. And so we've got to get that balance right. But it's for us as a community to decide what are the essentials, what is the minimum criteria that a graduation program should achieve. And it's for us to build that consensus and to hold ourselves and others to that, but also do it in a way that encourages people to come in and not keep people out.
What would you say were the core elements at this point? What is the minimum specification?
We've got to make sure that we're targeting the right people. The element of a big push investment is extremely important. If it doesn't have that, I don't think it qualifies as a graduation program. The investment now, given all of the research that has happened over so many years, we even are able to fairly accurately measure how much the size of that investment needs to be within a particular household for it to be meaningful, to move that family past this hump, get them out of the trap that they're in. there has to be a bunch of wraparound services. There has to be an element of coaching in it, because this program only works because it addresses both economic and social vulnerabilities. There has to be that element of confidence building. So all of that, I think, if we can bring it together, the big push investment, the other wraparound services, the coaching and handholding, which leads to conscientization and confidence building, and ultimately, it has to be a program that is for a specific amount of time. For us, it's typically 24 months. We've seen programs that are shorter. We've seen programs that are slightly longer. But the idea is it's intensive, but for a shorter period of time. And when you move people out, they can then have the wherewithal to continue to progress forever. Then it's not a graduation program.
You have achieved so much, but now we are at a time when aid budgets are under threat or they are not secure for a 24-month horizon. With the commitment that is necessary for a graduation program, are you worried that this approach is under threat?
We're seeing pretty profound changes in the global aid architecture. And given what's happened in the last couple of months, of course, you can't help but feel that things will get harder. Organizations, bilateral agencies that were the largest providers of almost stopped existing. And that's extremely problematic. And we're seeing the knock-on effects of that on Europe as well. When the UK government says that it's going to cut its aid budget and give it to defense, the government of Netherlands is saying that they're going to cut their aid budget. We're worried about the Nordic countries, Germany. We're entering a time where the traditional government bilateral donor-funded programming work will significantly reduce in size. And that's just the reality. I think we have to accept it. We've got to look at how to fund these kinds of programs differently. We've got to make the case that governments themselves, countries that have fiscal space to be able to invest in these programs, should be doing a lot more of that. And the countries that don't have that fiscal space should have access to funding from the World Bank or private philanthropic funding to be able to do these kinds of evidence-based, impactful programs that transform people's lives. And we've got to make a better case of that with maybe a different group of funders. Ultimately, I feel that whether you're a government donor or a private donor, you want your money to have impact and you want the best return on investment that you can have. What the graduation program represents is one of the best returns on investment. And I think we've got to continue to make that case.
We wish you luck, Shamaran. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
If you want to find out more about this, then the website to go to is bracupgi.org. That is bracupgi.org. And that's the home of the Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative. I would particularly recommend one of the blogs there. It's called Introducing the Graduation Essentials, Core Components Designed for Scale. It's from March 2025. It sets out very clearly what the essential elements of the graduation approach are and how they are sequenced and used. But I would also recommend it because of the references at the end. So there you find a long list of publications analyzing what has worked, evaluating the approach, also what hasn't worked quite so well and what we've learned from it there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will find articles about the topics we feature, and you will certainly find a lot of articles about the graduation approach in practice. And remember, if you enjoy what you're hearing, tell someone else about us.